This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
The Lux Radio Theater was a very, very successful radio anthology series. It started on the NBC Blue Network in 1934 and ran there until 1935. Then it moved to CBS, where it ran until 1954. Then it moved to NBC again for 1954 and 1955, and continued on the CBS television network as the Lux Radio Theater throughout most of the 1950s. The reason we don't hear much of it here is there weren't too many adaptations of movies that fit the format. You see, initially, the series adapted Broadway plays. Well, at least during its first two seasons. Then, in 1936, it began to adapt movies and moved to Hollywood. It was the most popular dramatic anthology series on radio for more than 20 years. The episode tonight is from October the 22nd of 1937. It's the adaptation of Robert E. Sherwood's The Petrified Forest. You may know the story. It's a pretty famous movie from 1936. It's about an actor who more or less wanders into a diner run by Jason Maple and his daughter Gabrielle, who throughout the play is just called Gabby. And then comes Duke Mantee and his gang looking for a place to hide for just a little while, mind you.
From Hollywood, California, the Lux Radio Theater presents Herbert Marshall and Margaret Sullivan in The Petrified Forest with Eduardo Gianelli. Lux presents Hollywood. Starring for you tonight are Herbert Marshall, Margaret Sullivan, Eduardo Gianelli, and Donald Meek. Our music is directed by Louis Silvers, with our entire production in the hands of that master showman, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille.
Greetings from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. The city of Baltimore gave us the Star Spangled Banner. It also gave us a little miss from Virginia named Margaret Sullivan. When Margaret was in college, her English professor returned an essay she had written with a brief but uncompromising comment, "For heaven's sake, stop acting." Margaret was just stubborn enough to ignore him, reasoning that a girl must have some fun. She's been acting ever since. Margaret has a farm in New Jersey, cooks excellent onion soup, likes fishing, and doesn't mind at all if you call her Maggie. This is her debut in the Lux Radio Theater, and we hear her as Gabby in Robert Sherwood's great play, The Petrified Forest. It's always a particular pleasure to announce the return to our program of Herbert Marshall. When last year Mr. Marshall was filming the Paramount picture Angel. Since then, with Barbara Stanwyck, he's made Breakfast for Two at RKO. His role tonight is that of Alan Squire. Two other splendid performers also make their Lux Radio Theater debut tonight. Eduardo Gianelli and Donald Meek. A comparative newcomer to pictures, Mr. Gianelli is already duplicating in films the brilliant record he established on the legitimate stage as a character actor. He comes to us as Duke Mantee, while Mr. Meek plays Gramp, Wallace Clark, Mr. Chisholm, and Frank Milan plays Bose. Our play begins. The Lux Radio Theater presents Herbert Marshall and Margaret Sullivan in The Petrified Forest with Eduardo Cianelli and Donald Meek. It's a little town in Arizona on the edge of the desert. It's a few minutes before noon, and the First National Bank is the scene of the usual midday activity. There's a line at the teller's window and a general quiet hum of conversation. Suddenly, the front door is thrown open, and four men stand in the doorway, leveling machine guns.
Stand where you are, everybody! Cut that game up! This is a stick-up, folks. Everybody just stand still and you won't get into no trouble. This is Duke Mantee here, and he don't take no fooling.
Now mind the gap. Get that door back there. Cover the door, Hank. Don't let anyone in.
Okay, Duke.
Got the door, Jackie?
It's in the drawer. Open up, you. I'm speaking to you, teller.
Open up yourself.
Why, you...
Don't argue with him. Open it.
Let me give it to this wise guy, will you?
I'll take care of him myself. You got the dough?
Yeah. All set, Duke.
Open the door, Duke.
Right.
Now, everybody stay right where you are. And if any wise guy's looking for trouble, remember, a Tommy gun makes a noise like this. That's just to give an idea. All right, Jackie, let's go.
Calling State Police, Arizona State Police. Duke Mantee, last reported to be heading west on route number 66. Be on the lookout for a blue sedan bearing Oklahoma plates. Be careful, these men are armed.
Warn motorists to avoid all roads in and about Petrified Forest area. That is all.
Warn all motorists. That's me, I guess. Maybe I should have been a little bit more careful about picking you up, brother.
If you mean I might be Duke Mantee, you can set your mind at rest. I'm not.
No. You don't look it, exactly.
But you're right, of course. That was a lonesome spot back there. I haven't had a lift for hours.
Oh, well, I took a pretty good look at you first.
And my honest confidence won the day.
Well, I don't know as you look so pesky honest. I just figured I was a match for you. My name's Jones.
Thank you. Mine's Squire.
Hitchhiking, huh?
That's right.
Where are you from?
Well, if you mean originally, it's England. If you mean hitchhiking, I started in New York.
And so? You're looking for work?
Well, yes and no.
What line of work are you in?
None just now. I have been at times a writer.
A writer, huh? Well, you won't find much to write about in these parts. Unless you happen to run into Duke Mantee.
Which I sincerely hope I do not.
How far are you going, Mr. Squire?
I'm not quite sure. I thought I might find some place to eat. I'm not in a hurry.
Well, the nearest place I know is a Black Mesa barbecue stand. The filling station.
The Black Mesa barbecue? Instructive, but not illuminating. Just where is it?
Well, I'm going within a couple of miles of there. I'll show you before I drop you. Old man Maple and his granddaughter run it. Ain't so much of a place, but, well, it's all there is.
What's the sad news, Gabby?
Oh, you had hamburgers, pie, and coffee. That's 50 cents for you, 55 for your friend.
Hey, how come mine's more than his?
Well, you asked me to put a nickel in the piano, didn't you?
Come on, Nick. Don't argue. Here you are, Gabby.
Thanks.
See you around, Gabby.
Yeah.
Boy, this place sure is expensive. I don't know.
Gabby. Gabby.
Yeah, Gramp.
Do you want to see Paula back there in the kitchen?
I told her Duke Mantee was heading this way, and she's putting sugar in the soup and salt in the coffee. She's scared of
home. Oh, you oughtn't to scare her, Gramp. She's a bad enough cook as it is.
Oh, she's all right. When do I get my dinner, Gabby?
As soon as I can get around. Mm-hmm.
Change to 20, Gabby. Lady wants a pack of cigarettes and take out for 15 gallons of gas.
Well, what kind of a car is out there, Bones?
It ain't Duke Mantee.
Well, now, maybe somebody is. They might have heard about him. Hey, I'll take the change out, Gabby.
Yeah.
Don't forget to turn on the radio at 7 o'clock now and get the news.
How's it going, Gabby?
Oh, all right.
Not so good outside. 10 customers all day. If it gets much worse, you can fire me and handle the pump yourself.
You're satisfied.
Hey, Gabby, come outside and sit with me a while, will you?
Not just now. I've got things to do.
Oh, you've always got things to do when I want to talk to you.
Well, to tell you the truth, I want to read. I haven't had a minute to myself all day.
That book there?
Yeah.
That's it.
It's nothing that would interest you.
How do you know? Oh, poetry. The shapely, slender shoulders small, long arms, hands wrought in glorious... Oh.
I told you you wouldn't like it.
Do you?
Sure. It makes me forget where I am.
You sure hate this place, don't you? Well, I didn't like it much when I first came.
Then why do you stay?
You ought to know that, Gabby. You can call me a sap if you want to, but I'm falling in love with you.
Yeah? Have you ever been in love before?
No.
Have you ever said you were?
Why, sure, lots of times.
Did they believe you?
Well, certainly they did. But I couldn't fool you, Gabby. I wouldn't want to. Don't you like me at all?
Sure, I like you.
But not much?
Some.
Enough for you. Not enough for me. What's the matter with me, Gabby?
Nothing. Why do you wear that football jersey?
Huh?
Number 42. You're proud of it, aren't you?
Well, I was pretty good back in college. Why, I... Oh, yes, I get it. I'm just another rah-rah boy, huh?
No, you're all right, Bose.
Say, what kind of a guy would it take to soften you up anyway?
Well, I don't know if anyone could. But I do know you'd have to be different. Not the people around here. You'd have to be like... out of another world.
Hmm. You're crazy, you know. Gabby, couldn't you pretend I was that fella and kiss me once?
Sorry.
Oh, come on, Gabby.
Stop it, boy.
Oh, listen,
Say
baby,
no.
I...
Good evening.
Oh, good evening.
Can I get something to eat?
Yeah, Miss Maple here will take care of you.
Thank you.
You can sit down right over there. Here's the bill of fare. It's kind of grimy, but the food's clean. Well, what do you think you'd like? Hamburgers,
oh,
steak?
I'll leave that to you.
Okay. Customer, Bose. Bose!
All right.
By the way, when am I?
Black Mesa. And it's even more dreary than it sounds. Where are you planning to go?
My plans have been uncertain.
Oh, just coming along?
Call it gypsying. I had a vague idea that I'd like to see the Pacific Ocean. And perhaps drown in it. But that depends.
Where'd you come from?
Quite a long way, Miss Maple. Is that the name?
Yeah, that's it. You're English, aren't you?
Call me an American once removed. Why?
I could tell you didn't belong around here.
Is that a compliment? Sometimes I'm afraid I don't belong any place.
I'll get you dinner.
There's his picture in the paper, Mr. Squire. Duke Mantee.
He doesn't look very vicious, does he?
Well, I'll tell you. You can't tell a killer except by his chin. Did you ever notice that?
I don't think I ever saw a killer.
Well, I've seen plenty of killers. You ever hear of Billy the Kid?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I knowed him well. He took a couple of shots at me once.
I congratulate you on still being with us.
Well, it was kind of dark, and he'd had a few drinks. I don't think he meant to do me no real harm. He just wanted to scare the pants off of me.
Dad, it's up and ready.
Well, by golly, it's about time. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Squire.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
Like the soup?
It's the best I ever tasted.
Well, shall I pour you coffee now?
Thanks. Your grandfather's a charming old gentleman.
Oh, Gramps, all right.
He told me he'd been missed by Billy the Kid.
Yeah, he tells everybody that. Did I hear him say you're a writer?
Yes.
Gee, I haven't met many writers, except Sidney Wenzel. Ever hear of him?
Sorry, no, I haven't.
He's with some movie company. He stopped here once on his way to the coast and handed me a lot of baloney. Said I ought to be in Hollywood. When I got there, to be sure to look him up. Gosh, almighty, they never mean it.
No, they never mean a thing. So you want to go to the movies?
Oh, Lord, no. I want to go to Bourges.
Where?
Bourges, France. That's where I came from.
You're not French.
Partly. I was born in Bourges. But all I know about it is from the picture postcards my mother sends me. You know, they got a cathedral there.
Your mother still lives there?
Yeah. Dad brought us back here after the war. Mother stuck it out for a couple of years and then packed up and went back. Some people think it was cruel of her to leave me, but what could she do? She couldn't live here. And you can't blame her for that. Do you think she was cruel?
Not if you don't, Miss Maple.
She sends me a book every year for my birthday. She sent me this one. It's the poems of François Villon. Ever read it?
Oh, yes.
It's a wonderful portrait. Mother wrote in it, "To my dear little Gabrielle."
Gabrielle. That's a beautiful name.
Yeah, wouldn't you know it'd get changed into Gabby by these ignorant desert rats.
You share your mother's opinion of the desert.
Yes.
But you'll find solace in the poems of François Villon.
They get this smell of gasoline and hamburger out of my system.
Huh. Would you like to read me one of those poems, Gabrielle?
No.
Read me the one you like best.
This one here. Where he wrote it about a friend who was getting married. At daybreak, when the falcon claps his wings, no fit for grief, but noble heart held high, with loud, glad noise he stirs himself in spring, and tastes his meat, and toward his lure draws love.
Description of car follows. Blue sedan bearing Oklahoma plates. There is a bullet hole in front fender, shattered glass and rear window. Mentee's girl is riding in the car with four men.
Turn that thing
She's
off.
Wearing a long...
This car is dynamite, Duke.
They've got us spotted, Duke. We've got to switch cars.
Shut up. Let me think. Doris.
Yeah, Duke?
You got to get out of this car, see?
We'll pick up another one down the road, and you and Mike and Flint can drive it around till the cops get off our tail.
Oh, Duke, I'd rather be in your car. I don't like to travel without you.
You'll be safer, kid.
As if I cared.
Mean that?
Don't you know it? Oh, Duke.
No. You gotta switch, kid. We'll get rid of this car, too, as soon as we get a chance. We'll meet you later.
Where, Duke?
There's a filling station about 10 miles past the crossroads.
That's liable to be a hot spot, Duke.
Then we'll cool it off. We'll take over the joint and stand off an army. You meet us there, Doris. It's a joint called the Black Mesa Barbecue.
Seeing reason wills not that I cast love by. Now here with reason shall I chide and fret.
Go on, Gabrielle.
Now cease to serve, but serve more constantly. This is the end to which we twain are met.
Waiting for the second act of The Petrified Forest, starring Herbert Marshall and Margaret Sullivan, let's stop in for a moment at a house on Franklin Avenue where a smart young secretary lives with her mother.
Mother? Mother? Oh, there you are. Oh, please be an angel pet and press my white evening dress.
Ooh, well, there's no knowing where a Kansas cyclone will strike next. Now, would you mind explaining why, if you knew you were going out tonight, you didn't phone me from the office?
Oh, darling, please get into action. This is a crisis. I'm going dancing with the boss's son.
Really?
And I couldn't call you because I was taking dictation all afternoon. And now I'm a little frazzled around the edges. I won't have time to do the dress
myself. My dear, you do look tired. Why don't you take a little nap? You'll feel so much better.
Nap? Oh, I haven't the time. Anyhow, I know something better and quicker. I'll just pop into a Lux toilet soap bath.
Well, I don't know. I should think that if you're
Oh, don't worry, Mother. My Lux toilet soap bath really does refresh me wonderfully. Leaves me feeling full of pep.
Well, you certainly always do look lovely when you go out.
Oh, you're just an old flatter. Well, anyway, there's another thing my Lux toilet soap bath does for me. Its active lather is a wonderful way to protect daintiness. And I love the delicate perfume it leaves on my skin.
Well, hurry up, dear. You won't be ready in time.
All right, I'm off to my beauty bath. Be nice to Bill if he gets here before I come down.
Mr. DeMille takes us back to our play. Herbert Marshall, Margaret Sullivan, Eduardo Cianelli, and Donald Meek continue with The Petrified Forest. A few minutes have passed. Purple shadows are gathering over the desert. In the Black Mesa Barbecue, Gabby and Squire, unaware of the approaching gangsters, continue their talk over the lunch counter.
And that's why you want to go to France, for understanding.
Yes, and I will go there someday when I have the money. I hope I won't be too old. I dream about it all the time. Bourges. There's something beautiful to look at, and wine, and dancing in the streets.
If I were you, I'd stay here, Gabrielle, and avoid disappointment. You see, I've been to France.
Oh, what were you doing, writing books?
No, planning to write books. You see, I married. My wife supported me.
Oh.
Well, please, don't think too ill of me. I once actually wrote a book.
What was it, fiction?
In a sense. It was a novel. Not very successful, I'm afraid. It cost my publisher quite a lot of money. It also cost him his wife. You see, she divorced him and married me. She saw in me a major artist who only needed a background to bring him out. She gave it to me with a fine view of the Mediterranean. For 8 years, I reclined on my background, waiting for the major artist to step forth and write. But he didn't.
And you've left your wife now?
Yes.
I'm glad of that.
I left her at her own suggestion. She had taken up with a Brazilian painter, also a major artist. Then I decided to go forth and discover America.
What were you looking for?
Well, that's rather hard to say. I suppose I've been looking for something to believe in, hoping I'd find something worth living for, something worth dying for.
And what have you found?
Nothing as interesting as an old man who was missed by Billy the Kid and a fair young lady who reads Villon.
I'd do other things that would surprise you.
I'm sure you do.
I wouldn't tell this to everybody. I paint pictures.
Oh, could I see them?
I never let people see them. I don't get kidded. They're kind of crazy pictures.
Oh, please let me see them. Perhaps it's my mission to introduce you to posterity as an American genius.
Are you kidding me?
No, Gabrielle. I've never kidded anybody outside of myself.
Mr. Bowles, you don't like your dinner?
What?
You don't like your dinner, Mr. Vos?
Oh, sure, sure, Paula. I always like what you cook.
Well, but you know it.
Well, I'm just not as hungry as usual.
Well, you sit and look at that door. And you look at that door. Oh, come on. You eat your dinner, eh?
What do you suppose they can find to talk about all this time?
Oh, don't you worry. Eat your soup. He'll be gone soon, and you'll have her all by your lonesome again.
Well, huh? You can't go too quick for me.
Well, that's a lot of them. They're terrible, aren't they?
I don't know. What made you paint with these extraordinary colors?
I don't know. It's just the way I feel and see. Are they any good?
I tell you, Gabrielle, I can't say. I'm tremendously impressed.
Gee, I bet I could improve if I could get to France. You know, they've got some of the finest art schools in the world there.
Don't you realize? There are probably thousands of artists in France today who are saying, I'd find a really big theme for my canvas if I could only get out to Arizona.
Yeah, I know. They say the desert's full of mystery and it's haunted and all that. Maybe it is, but there's something in me that makes me want something different. Maybe it's the French in my blood.
I wonder. Would you like to marry a Frenchman?
No, I don't want to marry anyone. I want to be free. Always.
Well, how about that stalwart youth outside there in the football jersey? When I came in here before...
Oh, he was trying to kiss me. That's nothing.
There's always a chance of development.
Yeah, he's after me, all right.
Do you think he'll succeed?
Well, I haven't decided yet. What do you say?
Don't ask me, Gabrielle.
But you ought to know something. You've seen a lot.
I don't know anything. You see, the trouble with me is I belong to a vanishing race. I'm one of the intellectuals.
That means you've got brains.
Yes, brains without purpose. No aim.
But you must have some kind of a purpose. Where are you going from here?
That depends where this road leads.
Oh, it leads to the Petrified Forest. It's a gloomy old place full of dead trees that have turned to stone in the desert.
The Petrified Forest? Mm. A suitable haven for me. Perhaps that's what I'm destined for, to make an interesting fossil for future study. Alan Squire, a specimen of the in-between age who was born too late for the Great War and too soon for... This coffee's good.
Here, have some more. You know, you talk like a darn fool.
I know it.
No wonder your wife kicked you out. No wonder she fell for you in the first place. What did you say your name was?
Alan.
Alan? I've been thinking.
About what?
Thinking how wonderful it would be to go to France with you. To see all its beauty through your eyes. To learn all about its art from you. You know, you can make an artist out of me, a real artist. You can make me think and feel. Oh, it would be glorious. Alan, could it possibly be?
I'm afraid not. I could never retrace my steps.
Oh, you mean you haven't enough money?
Even that is an understatement.
Well, I haven't enough either yet. But I've got a lot coming to me someday.
What? Are you proposing to me? Trying to turn me into a gigolo again?
No, it'd be different this time. Listen, do you know how much Grant has got salted away in the bank at Santa Fe? $22,000 in Liberty Bonds. I wish he'd give it to me now while he's living, but he won't. But it's all will to me. Of course, we might have to wait years and years for it, but if you'd only stay...
You think you'd like me as a life companion?
Yes, I know I would. And I don't make mistakes. Wouldn't you like to be loved by me?
Yes, Gabrielle. I should like to be loved by you.
You think I'm attractive?
There are better words than that for what you are.
I didn't say you'll stay, Alan. You haven't anything else to do.
No, that's just it. You couldn't live very long with a man who had nothing to do but worship you. That's a dull kind of love, Gabrielle. It's the kind that makes people old too soon. But I thank you for the suggestion. You'll give me something wonderful to think about during my lonely wanderings. I'll think of the chimes of Bourges. And you.
Oh, you mean you're going now?
Yes.
Well, I can't stop you.
No, Gabrielle, you can't. But you can do me one great favor before I go. Would you mind very much if I kissed you goodbye?
No, I wouldn't mind.
You would understand that it would be nothing more.
Yes, I understand. Just a kiss. That's all.
That's absolutely all. Gabrielle.
So, that's what's been going on in here. Who do you think you are?
Hey, open those.
Just because she's cute and sweet, you thought you could get fresh,
oh,
huh?
Oh, didn't get fresh. She only wanted to kiss me goodbye.
Yes, the impulse is rather hard to explain, but...
You needn't wait to explain. Just pay your check and get out.
Very well. How much do I owe, Miss Maple?
30 cents.
He's been eating all this time and only ate 30 cents?
Keep quiet.
30 cents, eh? That's very reasonable indeed. But That brings us to another embarrassment. I haven't got 30 cents. I haven't anything.
Oh, you haven't, huh? What have you got in your pack there?
Shirts, socks, a passport, an insurance policy.
And you thought you could pay with a kiss, did you? Why, I'll...
Get your hands off him, Bowes. There's a car outside. See what they want.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We'd like some gas and oil, please.
All right, Bowes.
How much?
My chauffeur will tell you.
That's nice of him.
Oh, and I'd like some cigars, please.
Don't forget the cigarettes, George.
Oh, yes, dear. I know. How far is it to the Phoenix Biltmore, young lady?
Oh, about 200 miles.
I imagine we can make it by midnight.
Well, goodbye, Miss Mabel.
Oh, just a moment, Alan. Excuse me, sir.
What?
Would you have room in your car for another party?
Who is it?
This friend of mine, Mr. Squire. He's on his way to the coast. He hasn't a car just now. He's an author.
Have you any luggage?
Just this rucksack on my back.
Oh, wait a minute. Joseph!
Yes, sir? Something you want, sir?
Well, do you think it's all right to give this man a lift to Phoenix?
I'm not carrying any concealed weapons.
Do you mind if we verify that?
Not at all. Go right ahead, Joseph.
Yes, sir. All right. I guess he's all right, Mr. Chisholm.
Oh, very well. Well, I'm glad to have you with us.
Hurry up, please. Oh, come on, dear.
Well, I've been waiting for you.
Well, thank you, Miss Maple. I'll remember your kindness.
Oh, just a moment. I forgot to give you your dollar change.
Oh, no. I wanted you to keep that.
Sorry, but tipping is un-American. We don't allow it. Go on, take it.
Thank you. I suppose I'll never see you again, Gabrielle.
No. That's the way it is in a gas station. They come and they go.
But somehow or other, I'll repay that dollar. Lord knows when.
Perhaps we'll run into each other someday in Bourges.
Perhaps. Goodbye, Gabrielle.
Goodbye, Alan.
What did you say, Joseph?
The lights are down there on the road.
Don't stop, Joseph. You never can tell what it might be.
It looks like a car pulled right across the center of the road. I'm afraid it'll have to stop.
Stop. Stop, you fool.
There's a man there. Three of them.
Shut up, lady.
All right, folks. Hop out. And you won't get hurt.
I say, what do you think you're doing?
We are borrowing your car, mister.
And no crack cedar.
Stay over there. Stay over there now. All right, Jackie. Hank, get in.
Thanks, folks. So long.
Can I help you with those plates, Gabby?
No, thanks.
Funny guy, that panhandler. When he was getting in the car, I got feeling kind of sorry for him and tried to slip him some change.
You did?
Yeah, but he wouldn't take it. Handed it back. Didn't mind holding you up for a meal, but he had too much pride.
That was awful nice of you, Bose. I appreciate it.
Say, you talk as if you were nuts about him.
Oh, I'm not nuts about him.
Well, if you appreciate it so much, how about being a little nice to me for a change?
Yeah, I'd like to be nice to you, Bose. I'd like to be nice to everybody.
Well?
I'll think about it, Bose.
Oh, gee, Gabby, you're a swell girl. I'm crazy about you, honey. Honest, I am.
In here.
Bose.
Shut up, lady. Behave yourself and nobody will get hurt.
Cover the back door, Hank.
Sure.
Who's the boss here?
What's it to you?
Listen, wise guy. This is Duke Mantee here, the world-famous killer, and he's hungry.
Shut up, Jackie. Who's in that other room?
Only one old
My
man.
My grandfather's in there.
Go get him, Jackie.
Okay, Duke.
What do you got to eat, sister?
Here's a bill of fare.
He's got a nerve. Don't give it to him.
Shut up, you. And sit down. Football player, huh?
Yes, and you better not let me get close enough to take a sock at you.
I used to be quite a fan.
Hey, cut it now.
Come on. Come on in here. Here's the old man. Sit down, Pop.
So you're Mantee, huh? You're the killer.
That's right, Pop. But just sit tight and you'll be okay.
You needn't think I'm scared of you. I've no real killer.
Gabriel.
Alan, why did you come back?
There's some bandits around here.
Yes, so we heard.
They stole Mr. Chisholm's
car. All right, buddy, take it easy.
Oh, my friend of the road.
Sit down, pal, down here.
Why, thanks, I'd be delighted.
That's Duke Mantee, Mr. Squire.
What did I tell you about a killer's chin, huh? He's a killer, all right.
He's a gangster and a rat.
Shut up, Bose.
Yeah, and if the sheriff finds out he's here, we'll have some real killing, won't we?
The cops ain't likely to catch up with us. Not tonight. So we can all be quiet and peaceful and have a few beers together and listen to the radio. Because I may as well tell you, folks, old Jackie there with a machine gun is pretty nervous. And he's got the itch between his fingers. So let's everybody stay right where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? This is a break. And no, I don't really like it either. At least I get to run off and hide until it's over. I'll be back real soon.
When you want to write someone's day, Tootsie's got a lot of ways. Give your Tootsie a Tootsie. Give your Tootsie a Tootsie.
One hour later, with Duke Mantee and his gunmen still masters of the situation, the Black Mesa Barbecue presents a strange picture. Gabby, Alan, Gramp, and Bowes are huddled together near the counter. On the other side of the room, the gangsters sprawl comfortably in their chairs, listening to the radio, machine guns resting on their knees.
Hey, Duke. What do you say we let him out of here?
Not yet. We gotta give him time to get here.
Maybe they got lost.
Not Doris.
Well, I wish he'd show up.
Waiting for a girl, huh?
Sit down, halfback, and sit still. I'd hate to see anything happen to you.
Let something happen. Let there be killings. All evening long, I've had a feeling of destiny closing in. Do you believe in astrology, Duke?
I couldn't say, pal.
I don't normally. But when I was coming back here along that road, I began to feel the enchantment of this desert. The stars seemed to be mocking me and saying, "This is the end of your terror. You thought you could escape it, but we know better." Perhaps they know that my death is imminent. It's a fascinating thought.
Let's skip it. Bring some beer for the bunch, sister.
Yeah, all right.
None for me.
Why not?
I don't drink with murderers.
I'd be a little tactful, Bowes. Remember, they're your guests.
Guests? Cowards that haven't got the nerve to tackle life with their brains and principles. They've got to use guns, yellow rats.
Step over to this side of the room, halfback.
What?
Come on, move.
Sit down, Jack and Gipsil. I want to hear the news.
Didn't you hear what he called you?
Sit down and keep quiet.
The gang made its escape in two cars, one of which contained Mantee and three other men. The other car contained two men and one woman. National Guardsmen are cooperating with the state police to bring to justice these killers, who are wanted for a score of bank robberies and cold-blooded massacres.
Take a bow, Duke.
And now we continue with the orchestra.
Are you going to make a run for the border, boy?
Oh, sure. And we're going to give you our whole route, so you can tell the cops to get us a motorcycle escort.
No, honest, Duke. Are you going on, or are you spending the night here?
Can't say, Pop. Maybe we'll decide to get buried here.
Better come with me, Duke. I'm planning to be buried in the Petrified Forest. That's where I belong. So do you, Duke.
Maybe you're right, pal.
I'm eternally right. But what use do I make of it?
Nothing. You don't make use of anything. Love, life, anything else. Do you, Ellen?
No, Gabrielle. Do you mind so much?
After you left today, I felt as if something had been taken out of me. As if I'd come out of a dream. I caught on to myself, and I know I'm just another desert rat, and I'll never be anything else. All that bunk about going to Bourges and art and dancing in the streets. Remember what I asked you about going to France?
Yes, perfectly.
But you wouldn't have done it, even if we'd had the money, would you, Alan?
No, Gabrielle.
I knew it. I knew you didn't give a hoot for me. Somehow it only made me love you more.
What are you saying, Gabby?
That I love him. Why shouldn't I say it? Why shouldn't he know it? We all be dead tomorrow morning.
You don't mean it, Gabrielle.
She can't mean it.
Well, I do.
I'm sorry now that I came back. When I went out before, it was a charming ending to a romantic moment. Now it's spoiled. Well,
sit down, pal.
What do you care whether I stand or sit?
I got to think about my health. Sit down.
If I had a machine gun, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I want to talk to Grant.
Me?
Yes. Those Liberty bonds of yours, buried in Santa Fe.
How did you know about them?
I told him.
What are you going to do with them?
Leave them right where they are.
Yes, leave them where they are. Your granddaughter is suffocating in this desert when a few of your thousands will give her the chance to claim her birthright.
Yes, and maybe give you the chance to steal it.
Hanging on to your money as though it meant something. That's a low way to justify your miserliness. Why don't you die and do the world some good?
Shut up, you. What do you mean, talking to an old man like that?
Hey, Duke, there's three people coming down the road. Looks to me like them people we took the car from.
Okay, Hank. Get outside and take a look.
Okay.
You too, Jackie.
Sure.
Duke, I was guilty of bad taste, and I apologize to Mr. Maple.
Oh, sure, sure. He must be drunk.
You'd better crawl, or I might have to put the lug on you. Talking to an old man like that. Get out of the way. Let me look out of that window.
Put him up.
Bones.
Now I've got you where I want you, Mantee. I've been waiting for a chance to grab your gun.
Yeah? And wouldn't you be surprised if Jackie was leaning in that window behind your back, ready to fill you full of holes?
What? Oh!
Thanks for turning your head, halfback. And thanks for returning the gun.
He got me in the hand. That doesn't matter, but I'm up the chance to kill him.
It was a good try, college boy.
Come on, keep moving. This is outrageous.
Here they are, Duke.
The same bunch, all right. I frisked them. They're harmless.
I don't know what frisk means, but he pawed us all over.
Come on, step on it. Sister.
Yep.
Take the halfback outside and bandage him up.
Okay.
Go with him, Jackie. Then you might tie him up and leave him there.
Sure. Come on, get going.
I demand to know the meaning of this.
It has no meaning, Mr. Chisholm, has it, Duke?
I don't know, pal. But if Mr. Chisholm is a smart guy, he'll sit down quiet to join the party.
Hey, Duke! I'm getting jumpy!
Shut up. Go out and see if Jack is with that dame and the halfback.
They're okay. He's tying them up.
I say, Duke.
What?
Would you mind passing me that rucksack? It's on the table there.
What do you want with it?
Just reach inside and hand me that little life insurance policy that's there, will you?
What do you want with your life insurance? Expecting to die?
You've guessed it, Mr. Maple.
Here.
Thanks, Duke. Now, may I take my fountain pen out of my vest pocket?
Okay, but take it easy.
What you going to write, Mr. Squire?
You'll see in a minute. Duke, I have a great favor to ask of you.
Yeah?
I don't think you'll refuse me because you're a man of imagination.
What are you getting at?
This insurance policy. It's my only asset. It's for $5,000. I've written on the policy that I want the money paid to Miss Maple, that young lady inside. If Mr. and Mrs. Chisholm will witness my signature, I'm sure it'll be all right.
Oh, certainly. I'll be glad to.
What's the idea?
Well, Duke, after they've signed, I'd be very much obliged if you'd just kill me.
What?
It couldn't make any difference to you, Duke. If they catch you, they can only hang you once. And you know yourself, they've got more than they need against you.
Good Lord, he is drunk.
You know, I believe you actually mean it.
Good for you, Mrs. Chisholm. You're a kindred soul.
You're in love with her, aren't you?
Yes, I suppose I am. I want to show her that I believe in her. And how else can I do it? Living, I'm worth nothing to her. Dead, I can buy her tall cathedrals and golden vineyards and dancing in the streets. One well-directed bullet will accomplish that. This document will be my ticket to immortality. Will you do it, Duke?
I'll be glad to.
Thanks, Duke.
Just let me know when you want it.
Pick your own moment. Say just before you leave. But I prefer to have her think you did it in cold blood. Will you all please remember that?
Certainly we'll remember.
Of course.
Mr. Squire, before you do this, let me tell you one thing.
Yes?
There ain't a woman alive or ever did live that's worth $5,000.
And let me tell you one thing. You're a forgetful old fool. Any woman is worth everything any man has to give. Faith, jealousy, love, hatred, life or death. Don't you see that's the excuse for our existence? It's what makes the whole thing possible and tolerable.
Did you hear that, George?
Yeah, I heard.
Mr. Squire, do you really believe all that? I mean, about women?
Of course I do. And there's a man who agrees with me, don't you, Duke?
I don't know, pal. I wasn't listening.
Then permit me to speak for you. He could have been over the border long ago, but he preferred to stay here and risk his life. And you know why?
Why?
Because he has a rendezvous with a girl. Isn't that true, Duke?
That's it. I guess we're all a lot of saps. But I wouldn't be surprised, pal, if you were the champ. Did you think I was kidding when I said I'd be glad to knock you off?
I hope neither of us was kidding. Did you think I was?
I just wanted to make sure. You're all right, pal. I'll try and fix it so it won't hurt.
You're all right, too, Duke. Thanks.
Okay, halfback. These ropes ought to hold you for a while.
How's your hand, Bose?
It's okay, but don't leave me, Gabby.
I'm sorry, halfback, but she's coming back inside with me. Go on, sister.
Gabby!
I tell you, Duke, we gotta blow!
We'll give him 10 minutes more.
Here's the dame, Duke. Say, what's this about 10 minutes?
You heard it. Turn on that radio.
10 minutes. Gabrielle, I got to speak to you.
You can wait until after they're gone.
I can't wait. I mean, when they go, I go. I have to tell you now that I love you.
Now, listen, Alan.
I tell you solemnly that I love you with all the heart that is left in me.
He does love you, my dear. He told us so.
He's Mrs. Chisholm. I'm quite capable of saying it, even if I'm not capable of making you believe it, Gabrielle.
Don't make a fool of yourself, Alan. They're all staring at you.
I know they are. But you've got to believe it, and you've got to remember it. Because, you see, it's my only chance of survival. You'll find a line in that verse of Vion that fits. Thus, in your field, my seed of harvester will thrive.
Alan, dear, I think you're kind of crazy. And I guess I am, too. And that's why I think we'd be so terribly happy together.
Don't say that, Gabrielle.
Why not, when I believe it with all my heart?
Well, maybe we will be happy in a funny kind of way.
Alan,
hey, get away from that guy. Leave him alone.
Alan, if you're going away, I'm going with you wherever it is.
No, Gabrielle. I'm not going away. I don't have to go any farther. Because I found the thing I was looking for. I found it here. In the Valley of the Shadow.
What have you found?
I can't quite say, because I don't quite know yet. All right, Duke. We needn't wait any longer.
And here's a news flash, folks.
Mr. Squire.
Shut up. Part of Duke Mantee's gang has just been captured.
Duke!
Just outside the petrified forest area, a car containing two men and a woman ran into a party of state troopers. From information given, the arrest of Mantee and his henchmen can be expected at any moment.
Turn it off.
Keep tuned into this station.
Doris, she squealed.
Shut up. Let me think. Shut up. Let me think.
No, Duke. Don't waste any time thinking. That isn't your game. You've got to keep going and going and going.
If I only knew where they took her.
You're thinking revenge, Duke. Don't. Don't give your life for anything so cheap.
Duke, for God's sake. All right, we're going.
Wait a minute. You're not forgetting me.
Listen! It's the cops!
Let me at that window.
They're surrounding the whole joint.
Looks like it.
Take Sir G.
Take lay low.
There's an end there. Are you coming out? Or do we come in and get you? We're talking to you, Duke Mantee.
Come in and get it, you dirty lout. Get down, you fool. You're staying here till we get a break.
Mantee, you have no right to endanger the lives of innocent people.
You folks better get down on the floor. Lie close together here in the middle.
Here, let me help you grab.
Right. Come here, Gabby.
Where is the light switch?
To the right of the door.
Turn them out, Jackie.
How many are there of them, Duke?
Six or seven. Nothing to worry about.
Gabrielle.
Yes, Alan.
It's an inspiring moment. United States of America versus Duke Mantee.
There goes the neon sign.
It almost restores in me the will to live and love and conquer. How do you feel about it, darling?
I don't know, Alan. And I don't care. Alan, when you get to France, what do you see first?
The fields and forests of Normandy. And then...
What, Alan?
And then Paris.
Paris, that's the most marvelous place in the world.
All places are marvelous when you've someone to love.
Even here?
Especially here, darling. As long as I live, I'll be grateful to Duke Mantee.
Alan, will you please kiss me?
Oh, Gabby. Gabby, darling.
All right, boys. Get on our way. Get out the back way and grab the car.
Now it's going to be all over.
Not for us, Alan. Never.
You better stay where you are, folks, for a while. Come on, Hank.
Duke, wait.
Alan, keep down.
Duke, you promised.
Get out of my way.
You can't go. You know what you said.
Get out of my way, Earl.
Yes. Duke, yes.
You still want it?
No matter whether I want it or not, you've got to.
Okay, pal. There you are.
Come on, Duke.
He missed it.
Alan. Alan, look at me. Get Rose. Quick, tell him to get a doctor. Hurry.
I will.
Alan.
It doesn't hurt. Or at least it doesn't seem. I went into this lung, I think.
Oh, it's all right, darling.
Gabby, I...
Oh, fool. Grab somebody. Come quick.
They were right, Gabrielle. The stars, I mean. I had to come all this way to find a reason. Duke understood what it was that I wanted. I hope you will be happy. Gabrielle.
What, Alan? What? I'm not going to be a crybaby. No matter what happens, I'm not.
Gabby.
What Rose?
They got Mantee, Gabby.
Did they?
How is that fella?
The doctor's in with him now. He's pretty bad.
Oh, gee, that's tough. He was a good guy up there.
If he doesn't come back, we'll bury him out there. In the petrified forest.
The petrified forest?
That's what he wanted. Doctor.
Miss Maybole.
How is your doctor? Is there any chance at all?
Yes. Yes, there is.
Oh, what do you...
He has a chance to live. If he wants to.
Oh. Let me see him. Let me speak to him. Alan, dear, can you hear me?
Gabrielle.
Alan, you're going to live. Do you understand? You're going to live, Alan.
No, Gabrielle. The stars ordained it.
No, the stars have gone. It's morning, darling.
Is it?
Alan, listen, you must want to live for me. Don't you remember you said you wanted to? Oh, please, Alan, please, darling, don't leave me.
No. No, Gabrielle. I won't leave you.
Oh, darling.
Remember the poem. Thus in your field my seed of harvester will thrive. For the fruit is like me that I set.
God bid me tend it. Good husbandry. This is the end for which we twain are met.
Man, I don't know. I think maybe she was better off without that guy. What was his name again? Nancy? Alan? Alan, yeah, I said it was Alan. I think she'd get tired of him real soon. I know I would. I gotta tell ya, that guy was a poser if I ever saw one. Posed his way right into the grave. Dummy. Maybe I'm just getting too old for the great dramatic gesture. I don't know. Richard Boone, who played Paladin in Have Gun Will Travel, as he got older and the show had been over for a while, said of Paladin that eventually he'd realize that this whole saving the maiden was kind of a waste of time, and that generally the maiden was in danger because she was stupid. Maybe that would have happened to Nancy. I don't know. Well, I'll tell you who's not a poser. Well, I guess Dr. Weird is a poser, too, in his own way. But he's here to tell you about the Tiger Cat, a story the doctor told on January the 2nd of 1945. Now, this is the way to see in a new year.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? Why, what's the matter? Surely you're not nervous. You are? Then perhaps a story might help calm you. I think I know just the one. It's about a cat. Among other things. That's why I call the story The Tiger Cat. My story, The Tiger Cat, begins in a little homemade laboratory in a great gloomy old house in the suburbs. Young Professor Carl Emery is bending over a cage containing a huge rabbit when the laboratory door opens.
Carl, have you seen Ron and Madame Elsa's cat? She's disappeared and Madame Elsa's worried.
What? Oh, it's you, Laura. No, I haven't seen Ronna. Oh,
Carl, how are your experiments coming? I get so little chance to see you to ask you about them.
I'm getting close, Laura. Look in this cage. That's a rabbit.
Why, it's as big as a dog.
It weighs 40 pounds and it's still growing. My vitamin injections have done that.
Then your growth serum's a success.
No, not quite. But I will succeed yet. If I can keep my experiments a secret from Madame Elsa. If she knew what I was doing, she'd throw me out of the house.
Oh, that crazy idea of hers. That when people die, their souls go into animals. It's insane.
It's the old age-old theory of reincarnation, but she believes it, absolutely.
Then she mustn't find out, that's all. Because once your growth serum is perfected...
It'll revolutionize farming. Rabbits as big as horses, chickens as big as ostriches. Why, think how the world's food supply will be increased. And I'll be famous, rich.
Then we can admit we're married. Oh, Carl, it's so hard pretending to Madame Elsa that I'm just a maid. But I have no interest in you, her brilliant protege.
I know, darling. And it may take months, even years, before my experiments are finished. I know she's left me this house and some money in her will. All our problems would be solved if she'd only die.
So that's how you repay my generosity, is it, Carl? By wishing me dead.
Madame Elsa.
Yes, Carl. I came in looking for Rana. So you've been deceiving me all these months.
Madame Elsa, listen.
Get out of this house at once, do you hear? Both of you. Leave this instant.
But my animals, my experiments.
Get out. You disobeyed me. Nothing here is yours. I paid for it all. So get out. Get out. Get out.
Catch her, Laura.
My medicine.
She's having a heart attack. Carl, get her medicine. It's in her room.
Well, no, I won't.
But Carl, she'll die unless you do.
Yes, she must die. Solve our problems. It's the perfect answer. But let her down gently.
All right, Carl.
My medicine. You're trying to kill me. You're murderers, both of you.
Another few seconds and it'll be all over.
Yes. Yes, but you won't escape. You hear? I'll return. I'll return. And...
Carl, she's dead.
And all our problems are solved.
What's that?
It's Rana, her cat. She's been hiding in the cupboard there.
She knows we've killed Madame Elsa.
Nonsense.
She's just... Oh, so that's it.
What?
Why, the stork has just visited Rana. She's just given birth to a kitten.
That's a peculiar coincidence, isn't it? Madame Elsa dies just as Rana's kitten is born.
Our story will continue in a moment. At this part of the program, I generally have a little talk with Dr. Weird. But tonight, I'd like to speak with you men. 1944 is over. 45 is here. Even though the sixth war loan drive is ended, your first New Year's resolution should be to keep buying bonds. After that, one of the best resolutions for any man is to decide to improve his personal appearance. Many men are keeping that resolution by getting a new Adam hat. An Adam just naturally does something for a man because its style is as up to the minute as 1 minute after New Year's. And quality. Mister, there's no beating the quality on an Adam with its genuine all-fur felt and careful workmanship. Step into one of the thousands of Adam hat stores all over the nation. Ask to see the famous Adam 5, handsomely styled in the smartest shades, expertly shaped to fit your head. And priced at only $5, the Adam 5 is truly a great hat value. Others priced from $3.45 to $10. But remember, no matter what the price, every Adam is right, this year or any year. Now, Dr. Weir.
And now to complete my story, the tiger cat. Carl and Laura were completely exonerated of responsibility for Madame Elsa's death. And so he was able to continue his strange experiments unhampered, with Laura, his wife, assisting him.
Oh, Carl, every serum so far has been a failure. The rabbits, the guinea pigs, they grow tremendously big and we think we've won. And
suddenly they shrink back to their former size, as if to mock us. But we will succeed. We must.
Oh, of course, Carl. I guess I'm just a little tired. That kitten again. Why can't we get rid of it, Carl? It's always behind me, always yowling like that, as if it's trying to startle me.
Well, now, Laura.
Carl, Madame Elsa believed that when she died, her soul would go into the body of some animal just being born. And that kitten was born at the exact instant Madame Elsa died. Suppose her soul is reincarnated.
Now, Laura, you mustn't be silly.
Look at her eyes. They're the same peculiar green Madame Elsa's were. And her fur. It's the exact reddish-brown color of Madame Elsa's hair. It can't be a coincidence.
Laura, you're being ridiculous. If we didn't have to take good care of Rana II by the terms of Madame Elsa's will, I'd use her in one of my experiments. But as we can't touch her, I'm going to get hold of another kitten, the same age, to experiment on. Then, by comparing Rana's weight with the other kittens, I'll know how much faster than normal my serum is making the other one grow.
Rana, we must get rid of her. I have a feeling...
Rana, my decision is final. Rana the second must not be harmed. Laura, look. It's only a month since I injected my serum into this kitten, and she's already twice as big as Rana. I'm going to call her Tigress. The rate she's growing, she'll soon be one.
Oh, it's wonderful, Carl, but can't we get rid of Rana now, please?
For heaven's sake, Laura, are you still harping on Rana? Why, she's just a kitten, perfectly harmless.
I tell you, she sits and watches me as if she hated me, as if she were just waiting for the right moment to be revenged on both of us. See, she knows we're talking about her.
Laura, if your nerves don't improve soon, I'll have to send you to Bermuda for a rest.
Oh, I'm sorry, Carl. I'll try not to be upset.
Well, that's better. I'm going to give Tigress here another injection. And I predict that in one more month, Tigress will be bigger than any house cat ever seen before on this earth.
Carl finally had to do as he had threatened and send Laura to Bermuda to get over her nervousness. Well, in her absence, he carried on his experiments alone and was overjoyed to see the kitten he had named Tigress gain in size at an astounding rate. In fact, when Laura returned at the end of 3 months, Carl had an astonishing sight to show her.
Now, Laura, now, be prepared for a surprise when I turn on the light.
Then you really succeeded at last, Carl.
Succeeded? Look, look there.
Carl, but that can't be Tigress. Oh, you're playing a joke on me.
No, I'm not, Laura. In that special cage is the kitten we named Tigress only 4 months ago. Now she weighs 200 pounds. And looks and sounds just as fierce as any wild tiger in the jungles of India.
I can't believe it.
Look, you see how small Rana looks standing there beside Tigress' cage?
Oh, she's trying to get out.
No, she's not. She's just playing with Rana. She and Rana have become great friends. Rana spends most of her time beside that cage. And I believe that they really talk together. Listen.
Well, they are talking to each other. And Carl, look. Rana is pawing at the bolt that keeps the cage shut. So she's trying to open it.
Oh, now, Laura, Rana's just playing the way a cat will. Why, I've seen her pawing at that bolt dozens of times.
But suppose she did slide it back and the cage came open. Tigress could kill both.
I tell you, Rana's just playing.
Carl, no. Rana is trying to slide that bolt back.
Laura, am I going to have to send you away?
Carl, she's done it. Rana's pushed the bolt back. Tigress' cage is unlocked. And Tigress is coming out.
Quick, I have a revolver in the library. Come on.
An instant later, Carl and Laura had slammed and locked the heavy door of the library. And outside it, Tigress roared in baffled rage.
She's trying to get in. She's going to kill us. Ron deliberately opened that cage so Tigress could kill us. She had a plan all along.
I'll shoot through the door. That'll drive her away.
Oh, you just made her more angry. Oh, she's getting in. She's going to kill us.
Look out.
When Carl and Laura were found some hours later, they were quite dead, ripped to pieces by the strange tiger-like animal the police found in the room, killed by revolver bullets. In fact, the only living creature anywhere about was a reddish-brown kitten with green eyes, like Madame Elsa's. She was calmly sitting beside Carl's body and purring to herself. Have you been unkind to some cat lately? You better be careful. There's no telling. Oh, you're leaving. We'll drop in again soon. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do.
A void. 5 o'clock. Shadow. Use Gem Blade. Use Gem Blade.
Next up is an episode of X-1, dating back to January the 9th of 1958. Based on a short story that first appeared in the November 1957 issue of Galaxy magazine, it's Gray Flannel Armor. You may never have heard of Finn O'Donovan, the man credited with writing this story. As of just a year or so ago, I'd never heard of Finn O'Donovan. I have since been educated and have learned that Finn O'Donovan was a non-diplome of really one of my favorite writers ever, Robert Sheckley. So, sit back and enjoy. I have nothing to say about this. That cannot be said better by Robert Sheckley himself. Here we go.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents X-1. Tonight, Gray Flannel Armor. Now, X-1 and Part 1 of Gray Flannel Armor.
My name is Thomas Hanley, and my case history is of particular interest to anthropologists, sociologists, and students of the bizarre. In its humble way, it serves as an example of one of the more obscure mating customs of the late 20th century. To begin with, I owned several gray flannel suits and many slim neckties with regimental stripes. Millions of us roam the streets of our great cities, footsteps firm and hurried, eyes front, voices lowered, dressed to the point of invisibility. But inside, I fairly seethed with romantic ideas of swinging cutlasses, of beautiful damsels, their hair shimmering in the moonlight. In short, let's face it, I was a romanticist. But romance is a commodity difficult to come by in the great cities. Life is too impersonal, too busy, too standardized. This particular Friday night, I returned from my office to my one-room apartment and prepared to face another long, dull weekend. Then the doorbell rang.
Good evening, Mr. Hanley.
If you're collecting for something, come back after payday.
My friend, I'm Joe Morris, a representative of the New York Romance Service. Main offices in the Empire State Building and branches in all 5 boroughs, Westchester and New Jersey.
You must have the wrong party.
Oh, no, Mr. Hanley. We're out to serve lonely people. And that means you. Don't deny it now. Why else would you be sitting home on a Friday night?
Well, the fact is...
You're lonely, and it's our business and our pleasure to serve you.
Serve me with what?
A bright, sensitive, good-looking fellow like yourself needs girls.
Girls?
Nice girls. Now, these young ladies I was referring to, Mr. Hanley, are not professionals. They are sweet, normal, romantically inclined young ladies. But they are lonely. There are many lonely girls in our city, Mr. Hanley.
Oh, yes, yes, I suppose there are. Funny, you never think of it that way. I mean, if you're not a girl.
True, true. Now, the purpose of the New York Romance Service is to bring young people together under suitable circumstances.
Oh, I see. A kind of, you'll pardon the expression, a kind of friendship club?
I should say not. We at the New York Romance have done what should have been done years ago. We have applied scientific precision and technological know-how to a thorough study of the factors essential to a successful meeting between the sexes.
Factors? What factors?
The most vital ones, my friend, are spontaneity and a sense of fatedness.
Oh, well, spontaneity and fate are contradictory terms.
Certainly. Romance, by its very nature, must be composed of contradictory elements. We have graphs to prove it.
Are you saying that you sell romance?
The very article. The pure and pristine substance itself. Mind you, I didn't say love. I didn't say common animal passion. I said romance. The missing ingredient, Mr. Handley, in modern society. The spice of life. The vision of all the ages. That is what we sell.
Very interesting. If I'm ever in the market, I'll get in touch with you.
No, just a minute, sir. Try our system for a few days absolutely free of charge. Here. Put this in your lapel.
Oh? Well, what is this thing? It looks like a small transistor radio with a tiny video eye.
As it happens, it is a small transistor radio with a tiny video eye.
Oh? What does it do?
You'll see. Just give it a try. Remember, romance is sponsored by our firm are fated, spontaneous, aesthetically satisfying, and morally justifiable.
Well, all right, Mr. Morris. I'll accept the free trial offer. Wear this in my lapel, you say?
In the lapel.
Well, all right. There it is.
Happy romance, Mr. Handley.
You're listening to The Gray Flannel Armor, tonight's attraction on X-1. Are you able to brush your own teeth? Not everyone can. Not a man whose arms have been crippled by polio. There are thousands of disabled polio survivors who must depend on someone else to help them perform the simplest, most personal acts. With your help, many polio victims can learn how to be independent. Right now, there are 100,000 survivors of crippling polio who need help. They need your dimes and dollars to pay for expensive care and equipment. Your contributions will provide trained hands to teach a polio survivor how to live with his disability. Thanks to you, a polio-scarred life will once again seem worth living. Remember, your generosity is the one hope of thousands for whom sock vaccine came too late. Join the 1958 March of Dimes. Won't you right now send your dimes and dollars to your local March of Dimes headquarters? Now X-1 brings you Act Two of Gray Flannel Armor.
After Joe Morris left me, I took off my gray flannel jacket and examined the small device attached to my lapel. It had no knobs or controls. It didn't seem to do anything at all. I shrugged, put my jacket on again, tightened the Windsor knot in my tie, and went for a walk. It was a clear, cool night. Like most nights in my life, it was a perfect time for romance. Around me lay the city, infinite in its possibilities and rich in its promise. But it was devoid of fulfillment. Nothing ever happened. I passed lighted apartment buildings and thought of the women behind the high blank windows, looking down and seeing a lonely walker on the dark streets. Wondering about me, maybe, as I was wondering about them.
Nice to be on the roof of a building, to look down on the city.
Huh? Who said that? I wonder. Oh, sure. This transistor thing. Hey, what was that you said about a roof? Oh, I guess it isn't two-way. Oh, it's not a bad idea, though. Would be kind of pleasant to look down on the city lights.
No. Not that one.
Well, what's wrong? Oh, sure. Wrong building. You mean this one over here? Oh, no answer again. Well, it must be the right one this time. At least I hope so. I walked into the lobby, and I remember thinking how you had to hand it to New York romances. They seemed to know what they were doing. I took the self-service elevator to the top floor. From there, I walked up a flight of stairs to the roof. Well, the air smells good up here at least.
No, not that side. The west side.
Okay. I hope you know what you're doing. I certainly don't. This turns out to be some sort of joke. Oh.
Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to intrude.
You're not intruding?
Well, I didn't see you at first there in the shadows.
I know.
The lights. Mention the lights.
Those lights. The lights of the city down there. They're beautiful.
Yes, like a great carpet of stars or spear points in the gloom.
Like sentinels keeping eternal vigil in the night.
Like sentinels keeping eternal vigil in the night.
Take her in your arms.
Take her...
What?
nothing. Nothing, a mistake. Come here to me.
Yes. Yes.
As she was melting in my arms, I caught sight of the small transistor set pinned to her shoulder strap. The one exactly like the one in my lapel. You can't help feeling a little odd about a romantic meeting set up and sponsored by transistor radios. I could visualize a million young men in gray flannel suits roaming the streets in response to barely heard commands from a million tiny radios. I tried to forget my doubts. The next night, I took another walk and found myself in a slum section of the city. I decided I had made a mistake and started to turn around.
Why not walk on?
You want me to walk down this alley? Oh, well.
Help! Help!
Oh, good night. Two muggers after a girl. I'd better look for a policeman.
Why do that? You can handle them.
No. A policeman can do it a lot better.
No, you must do it now. Oh,
but there's two men. They're probably armed.
You can do it.
Well, here goes.
No, you don't.
Now, wait a minute.
Let me go.
You. Good are you, rats? Oh, there. Hey, that. Ah, that'll teach you to harm a helpless girl.
Oh. You saved me. You saved my life.
I had to come.
I had to come.
Yes, I know.
Take her in your arms.
Yes, I know. I swept her into my arms and we embraced there in the darkened alleyway. As I held her close, my cheek brushed a shining jewel in her raven black hair. I had to look twice to recognize it, but sure enough, it was a tiny transistor receiver just like mine. I was suddenly angry. Oh, the girl was lovely, there was no denying that. And the circumstances were undeniably romantic until you realized that it was all a kind of cheap play. Faded and spontaneous, that was a joke. Angrily, I tore the transistor from my lapel and threw it into the nearest garbage can. I stalked away into the night, hardly realizing where I was going. I didn't really wake up until I reached the waterfront. I stood there, looking at the oily black water, and let the brackish-scented breeze fan my face. And then, unexpectedly, I was aware of another person nearby. The moon slid from behind a cloud and her auburn-tinted hair caught its light and held it for a moment. She turned her face toward me with frank curiosity. At this time, there was no transistor radio to throw me a cue. I didn't need one. It's a nice night.
Maybe. Maybe not.
The beauty is there, if you care to see it.
What a strange thing to say.
Is it? Is it really so strange? Is it strange that I'm here at this very moment? And that you're here too?
Perhaps not. No, perhaps not.
Let me look at you. Oh, you're really beautiful, you know.
Am I?
You know you are. Oh, you're lovely.
Do you really like me?
Like you? If I could only tell you.
Oh, I'm so glad. You see, I'm your free introductory romance, given you as a sample by Greater Romance Industries.
What?
With home offices in Newark, New Jersey. You see, only our firm offers romances which are truly spontaneous and faded.
Spontaneous and faded?
Due to our technological researches, we are able to dispense with such clumsy apparatus as transistor radios and... Sir, where are you going?
I was sick and disgusted. After that, there were several other attempts to get in touch with me, but I ignored them. I wanted no more to do with the romance game. In a couple of days, I called up a twittering aunt of mine, and she arranged a blind date for me with the daughter of one of her oldest friends. The blind date was a nice, friendly girl with plain, mousy brown hair. We were introduced in my aunt's living room, and we sat out on her sun porch and talked.
So you're Tom Hanley.
Yeah, I guess I am.
Your aunt has told me a lot about you. You work in advertising, don't you?
Yes, that's right. Madison Avenue.
Oh, I think that's thrilling. Advertising, I mean. It's such an interesting field.
Well, we like to think so.
Yes, I imagine you do all right.
Seems like it's warmer this evening, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. Although I don't mind the cooler weather so much. Lots of people complain about it, but I don't mind.
Well, I don't either, I guess. As long as you're dressed for it.
Yes, I suppose that's the secret.
Oh, I was just thinking, do you like bowling?
Oh, I don't know. I've never bowled.
Oh.
Do you like tennis? I'm crazy about tennis.
Well, tennis is all right. Yeah. I guess you could say tennis is fine.
I'm crazy about it.
Well, all right. So it wasn't romantic. At least it wasn't at first. But there must have been something about it. We began to hit it off, and we had more dates, and one thing led to another, and the first thing you know... Darned if we didn't get married. Yes, that's the story of my courtship. Of course, it isn't the whole story. At least, if you're making a case history, you have to know the important things. And to my mind, one of the most important of all happened after we were married. We bought a nice little house out near my aunt's and settled down in it. Then, one Saturday morning, I was out cutting the lawn.
Hi there. Did you say something?
I said hi. Don't you remember me? Joe Morris.
Oh, sure, New York romances. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Morris, but you better take me off the list. I'm married now.
Certainly, I know all about it. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, I know all about the way it happened. Introduced by your aunt, talking on the sun porch. Corny, old-fashioned stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking it, quite the contrary. Do you know what we down at New York romances call this?
No, what?
Hanley's mode. We studied you. A lot of commercial possibilities there. We've got it down on graphs. Effects of embarrassment on the psyche. The role of the aunt in American courtship. The whole works.
What are you talking about?
New York romances. What else? We've got a new service. It's called the old-fashioned plan.
The what?
We provide bonded aunts for young men to call up. We even have the aunt walk into the sun parlor at unexpected intervals with a plate of cookies or something. They say the suspense becomes... almost overpowering. Like our motto always said, spontaneity and a sense of fatedness. It never misses, my boy. Never misses.
Gray Flannel Armor, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Finn O'Donovan and adapted for radio by William Welch. Featured in our cast were William Redfield as Thomas Hanley and Guy Repp as Joe Morris. Others in our cast were Abby Lewis, Pat Hosley, Hetty Galen, Freddie Chandler, and Helen Gerald. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by George Boutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Strange Adventure.
Ben Watkins, the plantation manager, and his new assistant sat before their campfire in the heart of the Great Teak Forest. Lee Williams, the assistant, was new to Siam, and the noises that filled the jungle night brought him an unforgettable thrill. A cough and a low voice announced the arrival of a visitor.
Sahib Watkins, I need money. My friends buy drinks and play games for money, but my pay is gone. Please, Sahib, a little from my next pay.
Watkins' face flushed with sudden anger.
Long Chow, you know the rules of this company. We can't advance payments on your wages. Get back to your quarters.
The native scuttled away into the darkness, his face contorted with anger. Williams heard him mutter a single word as he moved away. Pusuk. He wondered what it meant and questioned the plantation manager.
Ben, water, who is this Pusuk?
Oh, Pusuk is one of our elephants. Half-wild beast the natives call the savage one. Long Chow's the only mahout in the camp that can handle him. He's killed 3 men in the last year.
Well, why do we keep such a dangerous brute? The men are risking their lives working with him.
Well, there's no room for sentimentality in the forest, my boy. You have to see him work to appreciate him.
The next day, Williams was looking over his gun when a ragged timber cutter crashed into camp with tragic news. Watkins, the manager, had been killed by the savage elephant. He loaded his gun and charged down the jungle trail at the heels of the excited natives. Not far from camp, he came upon the terribly mutilated body of Watkins. Pusuk, the savage one, had done his murderous job well. Suddenly, he came upon the man-killer. The elephant saw him, shook his head in rage, and moved forward. Williams raised the heavy gun to his shoulder, hoping he would be able to hit the blood-maddened brute in a vital spot. The mad elephant walked slowly, then stopped, and Williams saw that he was tugging at something that held him. With surprise and relief, he realized why the beast had not charged. His hind feet were securely chained to a large tree. One of the natives called and pointed off to the right. Williams could barely make out the form of a man sitting propped against a tree. It was Lang Sha. As he approached, the man remained motionless, and his face wore an expression of intense surprise. He was dead. From one of the natives that had worked with Lang Sha, Williams heard a strange story. Lang Sha, vowing vengeance upon Watkins, had loosened the elephant directly in the path of the plantation manager. So sudden had the beast charged that Watkins had no chance to escape. Then Lang Sha led Pusuk away from the scene and chained him up. Just as the mahout was almost out of reach of the elephant, the savage one had turned on his trainer. He had lashed out with his trunk, hurling the native to the ground. Lang Sha had managed to crawl out of the reach of the man-killer, but not out of reach of death, for the blow had injured him mortally. Lang Sha's vengeance had backfired, and his instrument of murder had caused his own death.
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
No Pets Allowed by M.A. Cummings. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Greg Marguerite. No Pets Allowed by M.A. Cummings. I can't tell anyone about it. In the first place, they'd never believe me, and if they did, I'd probably be punished for having her, because we aren't allowed to have pets of any kind. It wouldn't have happened if they hadn't sent me way out there to work. But you see, there are so many things I can't do. I remember the day that Chief of Vocation took me before the council. I've tried him on a dozen things, he reported. People always talk about me as if I can't understand what they mean, but I'm really not that dumb. There doesn't seem to be a thing he can do, the chief went on. Actually, his intelligence seems to be no greater than that which we believe our ancestors had back in the 20th century. As bad as that? Observed one of the council members. You do have a problem. But we must find something for him to do, said another. We can't have an idle person in the state. It's unthinkable. But what? Asked the chief. He's utterly incapable of running any of the machines. I've tried to teach him. The only things he can do are already being done much better by robots. There was a long silence, broken at last by one little old council member. I have it, he cried. The very thing. We'll make him guard of the treasure. But There's no need of a guard. No one will touch the treasure without permission. We haven't had a dishonest person in the state for more than 3,000 years. That's it exactly. There aren't any dishonest people, so there won't be anything for him to do. But we will have solved the problem of his idleness. It might be a solution, said the chief. At least a temporary one. I suppose we will have to find something else later on, but this will give us time to look for something. So I became guard of the treasure, with a badge, and nothing to do unless you count watching the key. The gates were kept locked, just as they were in the old days, but the large key hung beside them. Of course, no one wanted to bother carrying it around. It was too heavy. The only ones who ever used it anyway were members of the council. As the man said, we haven't had a dishonest person in the state for thousands of years. Even I know that much. Of course, this left me with lots of time on my hands. That's how I happened to get her in the first place. I'd always wanted one, but pets were forbidden. Busy people didn't have time for them, so I knew I was breaking the law, but I figured that no one would ever find out. First, I fixed a place for her and made a brush screen so that she couldn't be seen by anyone coming to the gates. Then, one night, I sneaked into the forest and got her. It wasn't so lonely after that. Now I had something to talk to. She was small when I got her. It would be too dangerous to go near a full-grown one. But she grew rapidly. That was because I caught small animals and brought them to her. Not having to depend on what she could catch, she grew almost twice as fast as usual and was so sleek and pretty. Really, she was a pet to be proud of. I don't know how I could have stood the 4 months there alone if I hadn't her to talk to. I don't think she really understood me, but I pretended she did, and that helped. Every 3 or 4 weeks, 3 of the council members came to take a part of the treasure or to add to it. Always 3 of them. That's why I was so surprised one day to see one man coming by himself. It was Graham, the little old member, who had recommended that I be given this job. I was happy to see him, and we talked for a while, mostly about my work and how I liked it. I almost told him about my pet, but I didn't because he might be angry at me for breaking the law. Finally, he asked me to give him the key. I've been sent to get something from the treasure, he explained. I was unhappy to displease him, but I said, I can't let you have it. There must be 3 members. You know that. Of course I know that, but something came up suddenly, so they sent me alone. Now let me have it. I shook my head. That was the one order they had given me, never to give the key to any one person who came along. Graham became quite angry. You idiot, he shouted. Why do you think I had you put out there? It was so I could get in there and help myself to the treasure. But that would be dishonest, and there are no dishonest people in the state. For 3,000 years, I know. His usually kind face had an ugly look I had never seen before. But I'm going to get part of that treasure, and it won't do you any good to report it, because no one is going to take the word of a fool like you against a respected council member. They'll think you are the dishonest one. Now give me that key. It's a terrible thing to disobey a council member. But if I obeyed him, I would be disobeying all the others, and that would be worse. No, I shouted. He threw himself upon me. For his size and age, he was very strong, stronger even than I. I fought as hard as I could, but I knew I wouldn't be able to keep him away from the key for very long. And if he took the treasure, I would be blamed. The council would have to think of a new punishment for dishonesty. Whatever it was, it would be terrible indeed. He drew back and rushed at me. Just as he hit me, my foot caught upon a root and I fell. His rush carried him past me and he crashed through the brush screen beside the path. I heard him scream twice and then there was silence. I was bruised all over, but I managed to pull myself up and take away what was left of the screen. There was no sign of Graham, but my beautiful pet was waving her pearl-green feelers as she always did in thanks for a good meal. That's why I can't tell anyone what happened. No one would believe that Graham would be dishonest, and I can't prove it, because she ate the proof. Even if I did tell them, no one is going to believe that a flycatcher plant, even a big one like mine, would actually be able to eat a man. So they think that Graham disappeared, and I'm still out here with her. She's grown so much larger now, and more beautiful than ever. But I hope she hasn't developed a taste for human flesh. Lately, when she stretches out her feelers, it seems that she's trying to reach me. End of No Pets Allowed. by M. A. Cummings.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
The following program is recommended for mature individuals and may contain material unsuitable for morons, cretins, and dishwipes. If you are a moron or a member of the PTL Club, please turn off your radio, because we don't need any more stupid, narrow-minded, pencil-neck geeks who wouldn't know the First Amendment if it came up and bit them on the butt. Thank you.
In the first recording, remember, the father waited for his little son's question. In this scene, the mother herself leads into the subject of menstruation with her daughter, who might be 10 or 11, perhaps older. The obvious reason is to make sure that a girl knows both the natural and the spiritual significance of this function before it happens. Parents are the best judges of the proper time and place for such instruction, but a good rule to follow here is better a year too early than 1 week too late. Notice how the mother starts with changes her daughter can see, the outer growth of her body, and then the inner maturing that comes with adolescence. There's an obvious bond of confidence between mother and child, which is essential in all sex instruction. Notice, too, how both the naturalness and holiness of the menstrual function are explained by the mother. There's an emotional overtone here, too, which contrasts with the more matter-of-fact presentation to boys. Here again, for convenience, the subject matter of perhaps two or more talks has been compressed into a single scene.
Well, let's see now. Fold in the whites.
Hi, Mother.
Oh, hi, dear.
What you making, cake?
Uh-huh.
Mmm, yum.
Oh, Betty O'Brien, get your fingers out of my ice in this minute. And how many times have I told you to hang up your coat and put your books in your room when you come in?
What's it worth to you, Mums? Licks on the bowl?
Oh, Betty, you're impossible. When are you going to start growing up?
What am I going to finish, you mean? Behold the evidence of old age descending on your darling daughter, Mrs. O'Brien.
Oh, dear.
Watch this coat sleeve. Watch it closely, Mum.
Mm-hmm.
An inch, 2 inches. It's crept halfway to the elbow before your very eyes.
Oh, Betty. Your father just bought you that coat a year ago, and it was too big then. Let's see. I don't suppose we can let that sleeve down anymore.
No, Mother, you're just not going to buy me another new one. I just won't have it. Unless, of course, you twist my arm enough.
Oh, it's twisting your neck I should be doing. Oh, but you are growing up, Betty. I can see that.
Oh, scales don't lie, except when Daddy gets on them. Oh, I hope I have a figure like Phyllis Graham's.
Betty, be serious for once.
I am serious. Uh-oh. I can feel a motherly talk coming on. I know that look in your eye.
I declare to goodness, sometimes I don't know whether to hug you or paddle you. You know so much, and yet...
And yet what, Mom?
Oh, I was about to say, and yet you know so little.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mom. I'll be good, really. What were you going to tell me?
Oh, nothing much, honey. It's just that... Well, with all these changes you can see, getting taller, and your breasts beginning to grow and so on, there are other changes going on inside of you.
Inside of me? What kind of changes, Mother?
Well, do you remember my telling you when you were little how babies grow inside their mothers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, from now on, through your teens, the wonderful machinery inside your body that will hold and nourish a baby when you're grown up, if God calls you to the married state, that machinery will begin to develop.
Really, Mom? Well, tell me about it.
Well, to begin with, every woman has two small organs within her body called ovaries. Now, each month, one of them produces a tiny egg, or ovum, as the doctors call it.
Is that the egg the baby grows from? The one you told me about when I was little?
That's right, dear. You see, God knew that when he did will to create a new little soul inside the mother, the tiny body would have to be nourished so it would develop from a little egg to a full-grown baby.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so wonderfully has God designed our bodies that each month, as one of the ovaries produces an egg, blood is accumulated in the lining of the uterus, or womb.
That's where you carry your baby, isn't it?
Yes, dear. Now, when a woman is married, the seed from the father, which I told you about, is planted inside the mother's egg. And this egg fastens itself to the wall of the uterus. That is what the blood is for, to nourish the tiny body until it is ready to be born.
Oh. That's wonderful, isn't it, Mother? And does that happen every month, even before a girl is married?
That's right, honey. It's part of the whole complicated process that the doctors call ovulation and menstruation.
But does the blood come anyway? Even when there's no baby to need it?
That's right, dear. But it doesn't stay there in the uterus when there's no baby. You see, when the egg is not fertilized, it dissolves and the blood simply flows out again through the vagina. Then the whole process starts all over again the following month.
You mean you sort of bleed?
Well, not exactly, dear. You see, the blood is simply stored up for a particular purpose, and when it's not needed, it just passes off. It's a perfectly natural bodily function. And a holy one, really, when you consider that it's part of God's wonderful plan for creating new little souls in his own image.
Oh.
You see, darling, that's why I'm telling you now about those changes that are beginning to take place in your own body. Someday, maybe soon, or it may not be for a year or so, you will have your first period, as it's called. Normally it lasts 3 to 5 days, but at first it may be only a trace and may not come regularly every month.
But, Mother, when it happens, what'll I do?
Well, when it does, dear, just come and tell me, and I'll show you how to take care of yourself and your clothes. The thing to remember always is that this is a natural thing, a holy thing. It means that God is preparing your body for the wonderful calling of motherhood, if that is his plan for you.
I understand, Mother. And thanks for being so sweet.
All right, now, darling, get those books picked up before your father gets home, or he's likely to forget you're growing up and use the slipper on you.
Oh, I'm on my way, Mons. But first, how about licking the bowl?
Betty O'Brien, I wonder if you'll ever really grow up.
I was completely prepared to make fun of this. I was and am offended by the use of religion in this piece and talking about God's plan for a 10 or 12-year-old girl. That really did annoy me, and I did find that creepy. Then I played this for a woman friend of mine, and while she agreed with me that bringing in the whole God's plan for little girls was not necessarily appropriate to this day and time, she also took me to task, saying, look, she thought that this had been a very good, very accurate description of what happens to a young woman. She really wished that she had heard this conversation, or something like this conversation, when she was a little girl. It would have made the event of her first period far less stressful than it was. Far more comprehensible. Basically, she told me to shut up. I think she was right. So the question then became, should I play this? Is it appropriate for me to play this? I mean, this show is what this show is. This show is about entertainment. I mean, the nature of this show is one of not shock. And let's not get too serious here, folks, but there is also an element here of what? Archaeology, maybe? Audio archaeology, if there is such a thing? A way to go back 50, 60, 70 years and understand what was in the air and understand how people thought. A way to study the artifacts of our culture, if that isn't too grand, and maybe it is, huh? I've been around for 63 years. I remember a lot of this stuff. I remember the 1950s. But some of you don't. And for those of you who don't, I'm going to leave it in. And for those of you who do remember it, like my friend Nikki, I'm going to refrain from any smart-ass comments.
Truth is stranger than fiction. This is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not.
George Washington, during his entire 2 terms as President of the United States, refused to shake hands. He always bowed in the belief that a handshake was beneath the dignity of a president. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about the most considerate uncle.
Deedle-dum-dum, there was a turtle by the name of Bert. And Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and covered. Ducked and covered.
Now, you and I don't have shells to crawl into like Bert the turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. Duck and cover. Attaboy, Tony. That flash means act fast. Sundays, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. And that's the first thing to do. Duck and cover. First, you duck. Then, you cover. You duck and cover. Tight. Duck and cover under the table. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. 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 Duck and cover yourself. Duck and cover. Duck and cover. Duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
Duck and cover.
Remember what to do, friends. Now tell me right out loud. What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Richard Dawson of Bradley, England, was probably the most considerate uncle in history. He was a very large man, so on his deathbed, he worried that his 300-pound body would be an inconvenience to his frail nephew after he died. So, to spare his nephew the trouble, Dawson walked out to the garden where he dug his own grave. After he had finished digging, he laid down in the grave and he died, believe it or not.
Well, okay, that's it. That's another Night Transmissions in the can. Well, almost in the can. Looks to me like we've got about 15 minutes here. So I'm going to play some music in no particular order, with no particular theme. It's just stuff I like. Oh, and before I go, I'm going to give you my email address in hopes that somebody will write me. If you so dispose, I'm available at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can also drop by the website. There's a contact button there. Oh, the website, as you might expect, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Whenever you're dealing with anything on the internet and night transmissions, www.nighttransmissions.com. There, I said it. See ya.
The very thought of you and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king, and foolish though it may seem, to me, that's everything. The mere idea of you the longing here for you you'll never know how slow the moments go till I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower. Your eyes and stars above, It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my never know how slow the moments go till I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower. Your eyes It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
drums to beat, my love. No longer can we stay. The bugle horns are sounding clear, and we must march. country, sons of Egypt, your rosy cheeks would spoil. Where the cannons, they do
the child, the bad.